wind, tide, Gulf Stream sucking out the energy. There's all kinds, geothermal, there's all kinds of renewables that we should be using. I am amazed that this country, with all of its pride, will tolerate a situation where 60% of our oil is imported. It's not domestically grown, so to speak. That's one hell of a vulnerability. There's a lot of not-so-stable countries in this world that are supplying us that oil. And we're spilling an awful lot of American blood protecting that oil supply. We wouldn't have to do that if we were energy independent. And we have the technology and the resources to do that. I'm disappointed that we're not applying it. I'm hoping the day will come when there'll be a lot more solar voltaics, a lot more wind, and so on. There's a proposal by LIPA to put the wind generators 4 miles off of the South Shore of Long Island. And there are some very uninformed people who say, no, you're going to be cluttering up my horizon. I won't have a beautiful view. But my binoculars 4 miles away, I'll be able to see those windmills, and I don't want that in my backyard. That's quite silly. Very, very naive opinion, in my opinion. Okay. I'm sure you've got another one of those. Look what you launched us into on that one, Mel. K2KEY. What's the next one? K2LAW.
Hey, this is K2KEY. Let me just finish up what we started. About trans equatorial propagation. I remember looking into this in the past. There was a couple of articles. I'll just make a couple of words on it. They found that anywhere within approximately 15 degrees of the equator, that's 15 degrees of what they've known as the magnetic dip of the equator point, that the F layer, the F region, had a higher than normal electron density, so that's why you most likely will experience that kind of condition as you get down towards the equator. So, okay, very good. I think that's basically, if you want to, in fact, if you want to look at more information on it, you can look up trans-equatorial propagation, or known as TEP. All right, let me see. I'll go on with another one. Look. All right, what is this? Okay, been mentioning in the past. Yeah, go. And I'd like to purchase some column filters. I see they're still available, but they have become quite costly. Do you think they're worth purchasing? I already have DST. Well, what about column filters? Column's mechanical filters have been around now quite a while. I like the mechanical filter very much because I find that it is, how would I describe, it is a type of filter which has got a very steep skirt and also a very natural sounding type of filter. And the filters are normally available in for CW at 0.5 kilohertz, sideband 2.5 kilohertz, and for AM at 5.5 kilohertz. As far as using them, yes, I have used them extensively. I put them both in after the first mixer, and I have also put them in after the second mixer. The general acceptance of the filters, of the mechanical filters, is usually a 455 kilohertz type filter. And they usually have a good spurious rejection. That makes them really wonderful because they have at least 60 dB of spurious rejection. So you find that if you listen to a receiver that has mechanical filters versus CST, I find that it's more natural sounding. That's my personal opinion on mechanical filters. I know they've gotten somewhat costly, but I think when the option is there, which seems to be a most piece of equipment that they offer it as a separate option, I think they're worth putting in have at least the, if you're interested in CW, get the CW filter, and we're definitely put sideband. You want to say some words on this, Nick? Go ahead.
Yeah, I think I agree with you, Mel. Everything I've heard about Collins filters on a Collins receiver, maybe on some other receivers, I have never heard anyone say, I don't like Collins filters. You can't dislike those filters. They really stink. Nice, round, proper filter action, just the right amount of ringing action, and so on. Digital signal processing, without a doubt, is capable of doing all that. I'm not convinced that the available digital signal processing pieces of hardware have done it yet. Eventually, we're all going to be voting with our wallet and our pocketbook, and we'll only buy the one for digital signal processing system that sounds good, that have the right dynamic range. Very similar to what happened when transistorized ham radios on 80 to 10 meters, the transistorized receivers, when they first started coming out in the early 70s. In the beginning, they had terrible dynamic range. They didn't sound good. They were easy to overload. They had spurious responses. They had other glitchy sounds to them. They started off with a pretty shaky beginning. Nowadays, nobody would use a tube-type receiver, with rare exception. On some very severe environment, I might use my Drake R4C receiver, because I believe it has the world's best noise blanker that has ever been created by mankind. I'm giving you examples of how the Montauk Point radar, when it was operational, and it was on the exact same frequencies I was on 432 megacycle ham radio, it would give me pulses 130 and 120 and sometimes 110 decibels above my threshold. I would turn on that noise blanker, and I could aim my antenna directly down the throat of that radar, and weak signals coming into the back lobes of my antenna from New Jersey on 432 sounded like hi-fi. I could swing my antenna around, aim it at the guy in New Jersey, put the deepest notch of my antenna pattern at Montauk Point, and I never even knew the New Jersey guy was there if I didn't turn on that noise blanker. That is a noise blanker. I still have that receiver. I'll probably die with that in my possession, if you know what I mean. I'm still in love with what that thing can do when you're using it as a tunable IF converter. So, Collins really knew how to build filters. Who cares if they're a little bit pricey? As long as you can afford it, I recommend you go for it. When it comes to filters, I recently have been tuning a commercially made filter by Cellwave, which has 10 poles to it. A little bit the volume of the filter, 10 poles. But when you tune it for the 900 meg ham band, it's got a beautiful flat response across the ham band. 10 poles of filter has a little bit more than 7/10 of a decibel of insertion loss. The skirt selectivity on those filters, just 10 megacycles off to one side, are 120 dB down. My goodness, the cell waves know how to make a filter. This filter is about 4 inches square, 4 inches high, 4 inches wide, and probably about 12 inches long. A little bit voluminous with those 10 poles in there, but wow, is that a filter. And when you properly tune it up and you look at its passband on a real good network analyzer, you see the steepest skirts you've ever seen. You see the flattest response across the top. It's what they call a brick wall filter. Man, am I impressed by that. I just didn't think 10 poles could do that. And I'm running an experiment where that's something I need to have. And if that thing cost $1 zillion, I'd have to buy it for the particular experiment I'm running. So there are filters in this world that'll knock your hat off. K2KUI, K2RIW.
WS2M for a question when you get a chance then.
Okay, let's make sure that Mel has finished his run of this particular question, then I'll go right to you, Paul. Go ahead, Mel.
Yes, this is KEY. Yes, ditto to what Dick just said. I have had a lot of experience with filters and making a number of different filter configurations. I have found that UK can't really believe how much filters contribute to hearing a signal, especially being interested in weak reception of weak DW signals, and living in an urban area, how I depend on the filters. So I have a receiver that I have got quite a bit of filtering involved with it, ways that I can add and subtract, switch in, switch out, and all. And I think I've went through the filters that I've homebrewed and the amount of work, and it was well worth it. Let me put it to you that way. Okay, all right, before I go on, somebody got a question, we'll take the question. Go ahead, Dave.
You got a call.
Okay, not related. This has to do with daylight saving time. Dick, can I go?
Go ahead.
Okay, I was wondering if anybody came across this. I have, you know, VCRs, different digital things hooked up to cable TV, and CBS sends a signal through the wire for the time. And daylight savings time comes around, and two of my VCRs, I don't even have to touch, they'll change automatically because of the signal through the cable. Now, you know, they changed it this year. They made it a week later, the daylight savings time, for this morning at 2 o'clock. I wonder if anybody came across this where last week they sent a signal through and changed it. Changed my 2 o'clock on cable, through the cable system. And this week they didn't do it. When they were supposed to do it, they didn't send the signal through. When I went around changing all my regular clocks, I changed the VCRs and my DVD recorder manually. It's kind of weird. I mean, it's not annoying. It's just unusual that something like that would occur. And yet WWV, they send a signal through the air. I think it's 60 kilohertz or something like that. I received that on my atomic clock, and that did switch today and not last week properly, automatically. Back to you, Doug. I wonder if anybody came across that.
WB2C, okay?
Okay, Bill recognized, and I'm going to mention the fact that I'm a member of Astronomical Society of Long Island, ASLI. And boy, there's been a huge thread for the last few days on that exact subject. Some people, depending on who their internet provider is, their Microsoft Word automatically got updated. Some of the other programs did not get updated. Various people have atomic clocks that did get updated. Some did not. Some of the atomic clocks were flipping back and forth on various days between daylight saving time and regular saving time. And finally today, it really settled out. So there's quite a to-do about all of this daylight saving time. The fact that you can buy a watch which knows the date and it automatically switches by what used to be the standard in the United States. And this year they changed the standard by a week. And therefore, a number of people have a watch that's updating at the wrong time because it was programmed that way to do it when the watch was manufactured. But Bill's going to straighten us all out on that. But we need to see you, K2RIW, the TechNet.
Hi, Dick. Good evening again. Well, I don't know about straightening you out, but yeah, I have a clock. I think it's a Timex or one of these digital clocks that says it automatically sets itself. Well, it doesn't really automatically set itself. You have to set it, but it keeps track of, like, the daylight saving time. And sure enough, last week, it went back an hour. And it's not through any signal through WWV. It's just programmed into the clock. And sure, a lot of them are like that, and some of these cable boxes might be like that, too. But I have Fios, and I noticed on my boxes they changed today. They all were the proper time. So I guess they do send the signal down, depending on what system you got. That's it. I got to get to bed and get some rest here, Dick. But, I have one clock that's pre-programmed to do that, and I don't think there's any way of changing it. It's built in. Back to you, Dick, in 7-8.
Okay, thank you, Bill. A person who just said query, your signal is a little bit weak, but try again, sir.
This is KC2JGH.
KC2JGH, Juliet Golf Hotel, question mark, and what's your name, and proceed, sir.
Yes, that's correct. First name here is John.
Go right ahead, John.
I have a question that's related to what I believe it was Hugo asked a little while ago. I'm in the process of putting together a HF station. I've got my radio already, and I was planning on putting up a 40-meter dipole about 6 feet off the ground as an MVIS, because that's the highest I can go. And I came across a dipole antenna in the HRO catalog, the Van Gordon Shorty, that'll do 10 through 160. And I have a, with the ladder line, I'd like to take that out and put a bow in it. Can you give me any help with that?
Okay, I'm a little bit light on HF equipment, but Mel, maybe you can answer that question. I'm in great shape tonight. K2KEY, go ahead, Mel.
Okay, this is K2KEY. What does he want to do? Actually, he wants to foreshorten the change the dipole, and in other words, replace the open wire feeders. Is that what he's looking to replace with coax, basically, over?
You have to answer that question, John. Go right ahead.
That's correct. I'm looking to replace the ladder line with the coax feed.
You got it, Mel.
Okay, well, you take a dipole that's just basically a dipole. The ladder line is, you'll find, will work better. Less, of course, plus the antenna is basically, as it comes through the Van Gordon, as a antenna that was cut and trimmed and all, and found that ladder line was ideal. No big deal with the ladder line. We've discussed many times how you can bring it into the shack a number of different ways, or I think it suggested that you could bring a piece of coax out and just join it outside the window and then bring a piece of coax in. There's no reason to, take that ladder line out. If you do, you can retrim the antenna. Of course, you can get a what they call a center dipole support for coax, or sort of a unit that they sell that can bring coax right up to the dipole as a hook on each end to the wire, and it also locks the coax so that it won't pull out. Or you can get one of, if you want to be more classic, of course, you can get one of those valves that they sell where you can screw the coax with a connector, CL-259, right on the bottom of the phallum, which also comes with the two rings, the two hooks on the side to support the dipole. I mean, there's several ways you can go. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah. There's always a large number of ways of feeding an antenna, dipole-like antenna. And if you follow all the rules for that particular technique, essentially all of them work. There are various people who will say, gee, my favorite way of feeding a dipole is with a gamma match rod, or with a T match, or a delta match, or a folded dipole, or in the case of G5RV-like antennas with the Lou Varney technique of a certain amount of coax and a certain amount of ladder line. Lots and lots of ways of doing it. And I think you're asking, which is the best way, and I'm not sure I've got a great answer for that, John, but that's about as far as I think we can go on that particular one. Mel, why don't you go dip at least once more into your mailbag, Mel, K2RIW.
Okay, final words on it. This is K2KEY. I would use the antenna just as it is and just stay with that ladder line. It works excellent. Put into a balance so you get a tuner. Just go into balance input, and you'd be very happy with it. There's nothing wrong with using ladder line. Don't believe any of the nonsense about ladder line causing you different PI problems, shielded, and all that stuff. A bunch of baloney. All right, let's see. Where were we? Okay, there we go. Oh, more antenna questions. There we go with antenna questions. All right. Last week, you guys discussed vertical. The gap vertical. Back to that again. We thought and discussed some gap verticals. We never really got very far into it because I guess I never really understood completely what they're doing there. So I can't really comment further on it. Dick, did you at all investigate that antenna with the elevated feed over?
Well, I went to the website, saw the pictures, and tried to get as much information that way. I don't have the owner's manual, which maybe will give you a little bit more information. I believe there have been some articles written by A.R. Arell, among other people, that give further explanation, and it would be fun to read those. The bottom line of all this is that there's something called the Bode-Fano impedance matching equation. In other words, if you know the impedance of your particular device as you sweep it in frequency, if you know the resistive component and the reactive component, there is a set of equations that were written by those two people which tell you what's the best impedance match you can get across that particular frequency region with a lossless LC network. So by way of those extra rods they got hanging on the sides, it has some of the appearance, in my opinion, of a fan dipole. But it's folded back in a funny way. But there are also, if you just Google the word dipole broadbanding technique, and I Googled that exact set of words about a month and a half ago, and you get a large number of articles on various techniques for using coax cable, lateral line, and whatever, within the dipole itself as an impedance matching procedure. The epitome of impedance matching, though, was indicated in the December issue, 2006, the December issue of Antennas and Propagation Proceedings of the IEEE, Antennas and Propagation Journal. There was a dipole that instead of covering a 5 or 8% bandwidth, it covered 100% bandwidth. In other words, you can make a dipole that is centered at 400 megacycles, and it's nearly 400 megacycles broad. A technique for extreme broadbanding of a dipole, and this is a technique where the person who wrote the article perfected it just as an experiment at 1,000 megacycles using printed circuit material, FR4 material. He did some very elaborate computer modeling by what's called the generic technique. Generic technique. In other words, if you believe in what Mother Nature does with evolution, in other words, a slow changing of the species so that it adapts itself to the particular environment, he wrote a computer program that does that. And so he asked the computer program, make the dipole operate over 50%, 75%, 100%, 150% bandwidth. And he gave it enough resources with some parasitic elements alongside of the dipole. But what he eventually came up with is a dipole that over 100% bandwidth, doesn't exceed 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, with no change in the dipole gain or pattern. He just added some parasitic elements alongside of the dipole with close coupling. So quite possibly the gap antenna is doing something a little bit similar to that. If you're willing to add extra resonators and parasitic elements, you'll be amazed what kind of bandwidth and multi-frequency operation you can get. I've often said there's something close to 5,000 kinds of antennas. Well, by my standards, that December issue 2006 of Antennas and Propagation just gave us 2001, and the gap antenna maybe is giving us 2002. You haven't heard the end of the story. If you think mankind has invented all the antennas and documented them, you better go back to the books and dig a little bit deeper. We haven't heard the end of the story. For we amateurs, that's an exciting idea, because none of us build our 80 to 10 meter transceiver these days. We buy that. But when it comes to experimenting on antennas, we've got the money, we've got the time, The raw materials are not expensive, and therefore we can do that. And as such, it's a fun thing to do. Most antennas that you build in your backyard and you mount in the air are not very expensive. Don't build just one. Wire is something that your neighbors don't even see. Build one for east-west, build another one for north-south, build one that's high, build one that's low. Try various techniques. Wire Yagi antennas, log periodic catenary suspended antennas, and so on. The materials are not great, and you'll have a lot of fun at doing that experiment. So, GAP, if we dig deeper, I guarantee GAP is going to teach us a few things by how that antenna works. K2KEY,
K2LIW. Yeah, well, I tried to read that article that I had mentioned that when it reviewed in USD, how it works, and I'm not really sure completely because the way the author even admitted that he's not sure completely how it achieves the match on all the bands. Now, the question here is, he wants to know if he wants to purchase an antenna. Am I better to get a vertical antenna that has an elevated feed, or am I better to use a conventional one with floating coils? What would you suggest? I only have a limited amount of space. I don't know what to say, really. Dick, would you think that a vertical antenna with an elevated feed would be superior? I don't know what to really say to this, Dick, over.
Okay, my VHF experience and everything I read about so-called vertical ground plane antennas, quarter-wave ground plane with ground plane radios, tells me that until you lay a lot of copper down, there is a hidden loss that a lot of people don't know about. The average guy follows the instructions on his antenna that says put down 4 radials, and the manufacturer didn't want to tell you to put down 32 radials, for fear that you wouldn't buy the antenna. It's too much work. So you put down 4 radials, you measure the standing wave ratio, you find out all the energy is going down the cable, not much of it is coming back into the shack. You make the assumption that all of it's being radiated into space. Well, a lot of it gets coupled into the earth, unless that earth looks like a sheet of copper, which means you're laying down a whole lot of ground plane radials. With an elevated feed point, which is just fancy words of saying you're building a full vertical dipole. That's what's really going on with this GAP antenna from everything I can see. It is a full half-wave vertical dipole electronically. That's what that elevated feed point is giving you. And as such, there is no better way to make a counterpoise for a quarter-wave monopole antenna than another quarter-wave monopole, back-to-back. You and I call that half-wave dipole. If you've got the ability, if you've got a tree that's tall enough, you've got a tower that's tall enough, that you can build or buy a pure vertical half-wave dipole, guarantee you're going to be very pleased with the performance. For reasons I don't understand, that's an extremely unpopular antenna. You don't read any substantial number of articles on how to build a half-wave vertical dipole. To do it extremely simply, you would bring the coax cable at right angles away from the center of the dipole, off to one side a little bit before you bring it down in the shack. However, if you look at N-fed, the Zucker-type dipoles, there's ways that you can bring the feed line up the bottom, outer end of the vertical half-wave dipole. But it gives you a low angle of radiation. You don't have to lay down a whole bunch of counterpoise ground plane rods, wires, and be high in efficiency, and it doesn't couple your valuable RF energy into the soil in your backyard like a quarter-wave ground plane will do if you have only 4 radials down there. There's a lot of gaps in between. The RF energy sees those gaps, and the RF and the soil under your antenna is a moderately good dummy load, and you're going to be heating up the soil with your RF energy. And yeah, the worms are going to be happy in the wintertime because they're a little bit warmer when you press down the key of your transmitter or push the talk switch, but that's not where you want your RF energy to go. So altitude always helps when it comes to a horizontal dipole. When it comes to a vertical dipole, as long as the bottom of it is a few feet off the ground, it's a full half-wave vertical dipole electronically. and you can fan it out, you can put loading coils, you can do all kinds of things on a vertical dipole. But if you feed it in the center, elevated feed, it is my strong belief you're going to have a hell of a lot more performance than anything that's mounted on the ground that doesn't have 32 radials to it. That's my belief. K2KEY, K2LIW.
I wholly agree. This is K2KEY. I've done a number of experiments in that direction. I used a vertical dipole for 40 meters, and it worked phenomenal. I will say that the cup is 65 feet up, and it's coming down not at a complete vertical. Now, this is another somewhat of a strange and abnormal condition that I found, maybe because of this, maybe my location. But what I did is I had the dipole originally, the 40-meter dipole, coming just basically straight down and tied off almost at the ground level. I found if I sloped it with approximately 60 degrees with the ground level, for some reason, maybe I'm just picking up a little bit different angle of radiation considering, you know, the conditions and all, but I found that I'm hearing Europeans better. I could say maybe just because of the location or whatever, it's just, but I think that it's a simple, straightforward antenna. It's nothing there magical. If you can have a spot, a tree or whatever, a limb, just pull it up. That's it. Pull the dipole up and feeding it right in the center with nothing but the coax. Got one of those commercial type gadgets that they sell because they had it at Hamfest selling very cheap. It's got a bunch of screws that you put the two half a cases together, and it's got a quarter inch eye on each side. And the only thing I will say to you, what you should do, is to the eye, is make sure you solder the coax where inside the unit, to solder the coax to each one of the eyes, the braid to one side and the center to the other side, close it up, and put all the screws in. They give you a bunch of 632 screws, about a dozen of them, to hold the thing together. And it holds the cable so you can pull it off at right angles, and it works excellent on 40 meters, if that's what you're looking for. And as Dick says, the price is right. Should we go on with another one, Dick? Over.
Yeah, I'm going to add a couple more words to this one. When you're trying to construct a vertical, electronically half-wave dipole, elevated feed dipole, and I say electronically means that you can mechanically shorten it if you don't have a tall enough tree or a tall enough tower, and put in loading coils, top hat capacitors, zigzag it, you can do all kinds of things. But even if you tilt it 10, 20, 30, 45 degrees from vertical, in my mind it's still a vertical antenna, and you're not losing anywhere near as fast as you would think. First of all, that signal coming to you by way of the ionosphere is twisting every which way it wants to in polarization. Faraday rotation, it's called. The ionosphere is a plasma. The Earth supplies a magnetic field. Whenever you mix together a plasma and a magnetic field, you will see rotating polarization, some significant number of degrees, and in some cases even multiple twists, multiple rotations. The bottom line is that that buddy of yours in London launches a purely horizontal signal in your direction, and when it gets to your backyard, it twists two or three times and ends up vertical. So when you tilt your antenna a little bit away from vertical, are you getting an advantage or a disadvantage? The answer is yes, depending on what day, what hour, what band, what state of the ionosphere, and so on. Second of all, even if the signal came to you purely vertically polarized, and your antenna is tilted over at a 30-degree angle from vertical, the voltage that your dipole picks up is cosine of angle. If it's 0 degrees, cosine of angle is 1. You pick up unity in voltage. If the antenna is tilted 30 degrees, which looks like a whole lot to your eye, cosine of 30 degrees is 0.87. 87% of the voltage is still picked up by your dipole when it's tilted 30 degrees from the polarization of the signal coming into you. So if your property is laid out in such a way, it's a convenient way, you have to tilt the dipole a little bit, like 30 and 45 degrees. 45 degrees is 0.707 of the voltage. It's still going to work. The antenna is not going to explode because you've made some kind of an error. You're going to do some testing of standing wave ratio, signal strength. You're going to ask people for S-meter readings. You're going to find out how well it works. And if you don't like it, you make changes. Keep making changes until you don't like it. Put up more of them. The materials are not that expensive, and antenna experimenting is a very fun process. Guarantee it. K2KEY. Go to the next one if you like. K2LIW.
Okay, very good. This is K2KEY. All right, let me carry on. I get another one on that. I'm vertical. It's an interesting one. Can I shorten? I don't have room for a radio to really spread them out. And I would like to shorten the radio. Now, you talked about sub. Can I use the sub method to shorten the radio? You know, that's an interesting concept. I guess the answer is yes. I guess you could make quarter wave stubs out of coax cable that could act as radio subject. Over.
Yeah, but I'm not sure you want to do that, Mel. What I've read leads me to believe that if I'm laying out a good number of radials, I'm going to pick a number, 12 radials. If I made them out of skinny wire or fat wire, I get almost the same performance, not counting the resistance of the wire. If I'm using copper wire and I use 18 gauge or 6 gauge, I'm going to get very close to the same performance. So diameter of wire and going all the way up to a coax cable doesn't buy a great deal. Now, each one of those quarter wave radials is electronically a quarter wave length long. And if you shrink them to a shorter distance because you don't have enough property, and you re-resonate them with loading coils and top hat capacitors and a ring of wire around the perimeter of your radials, and by the way, that's a good thing to do, a ring of wire around the perimeter of your radials. There are antennas that use that concept. I think GAP is using it. That's got some great benefits. Makes it look a little bit more like a sheet of metal, even though it's really a bunch of wires laying on the ground. And elevating the wires of the ground plane above the ground gives you a benefit. Doesn't allow you to couple into the earth as much. It's becoming an elevated feed, so to speak. Now, could you put a quarter wave, half wave, open circuit, short circuit, or whatever stuff at right angles to each one of your radials because they're too short and re-resonate them? Yes, you could, but I'm not convinced you're going to get all the benefit you want out of that one. The main function of the radials is for the first quarter wave in every direction, you want your earth to look like a sheet of copper. It's really a skeleton sheet of copper as you lay down those radials. But if the gap between the wires is a small enough fraction of a wavelength, the RF energy will not propagate through those wires into the ground. It will think it's a sheet of copper. So it's the number of wavelengths of spacing at the perimeter between your individual radial accounts. So yes, you can shorten those radials. Yes, you can re-resonate them. But if the antenna is close to the ground, you now have some unprotected ground out there beyond where the radio would have been if you went to full length. So I think you're going to get a slightly compromised performance. But that's a guess. That's a speculation. I haven't done it. I do know that as you elevate the antenna above Earth, the performance improves. As you put down more radials, the performance improves. As you put down more radials that are short and long, and some of them go out further in distance beyond quarter wave, the performance improves. You're trying to make your backyard look like a sheet of copper if you insist on making a quarter-wave monopole, quarter-wave ground plane type antenna. In my opinion, it takes so much extra effort to make that work well, I don't think it's a good investment. But that's my opinion. There are lots of guys out there with a quarter-wave ground plane radio, and they love it. Quarter-wave ground plane antenna, and they love it. The people who elevate it, elevate the feed point, go closer to half-wave, I think they're happier. I think they're getting more bang for the dollar. Those are some of my opinions. K2KEY, K2RW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Well, this is up on the roof. Now, let's explore this a little further because I once thought about this a little bit in depth. It comes back to me now. If we took a quarter wave wave, now it's a problem. In other words, he's looking for a situation where he's going to pick up, you know, be able to spread it out on the roof a little better. So he wants to use subnet. And I'm just thinking, if we took a quarter wave wave piece of coax and we just stuck it there so that, well, it was just a... In other words, leave the shield going nowhere, really, just the shield there. And the once the end, the center, we hook it to the shield at the base of the vertical on the roof. The, let's see, the coax would actually say, let's say we use coax that would be, say, with a velocity factor, say, about 0.66. So in other words, would be approximately 60 degrees long on the outside of the shield. So now what would happen? At the feed point, bottom of your antenna, this I would assume. And so, I would think you could, or dip it and trim it, that you would be able to have maybe be able to straighten out the pattern because you'd be able to pick up some more room. In other words, figuring this way. In other words, the it sounds reasonable that it's possible that you could because of the you wouldn't have to try. You'd leave this, in other words, just use this piece of coax strictly as a sub. Put the center of the cable to the shield. Leave the shield unhooked, judging by that, we have approximately about a quarter wavelength. It would act as a quarter wavelength at about 60 degrees if it had a velocity factor of about 0.66. Am I on the right track, Dick? Over.
Yeah, I see where you're going with this, Mel. As you lay down ground plane radials, you're doing two things at once. Number one, you usually lay them down a length so that they resonate, so that they're a quarter wavelength long resonator. The far end is somewhat of an open circuit, not counting ground effect loading. And therefore the input end is close to a short circuit, and that's what you want the coax cable to see. You want the coax cable to connect to the counterpoise, to see a short circuit to the universe. The center conductor of your coax goes to the vertical radiator. So resonating the radial is the first step in making them work pretty well. They don't necessarily have to resonate, though. If I lay down a whole lot of very long radials in the earth or on top of the earth, I would also have an extremely effective ground plane antenna. I just used an elaborate way of making my backyard look like a sheet of copper, which reflects the other half of the vertical radiator into the earth as a mirror image, and it thinks it's a dipole by way of the mirror image. So I'm trying to make my copper, my backyard look like a sheet of copper. So resonating them helps, but they don't have to be resonated. And the second function is you want enough copper down so that the spacing between the radials, the maximum spacing, is a fraction of a wavelength, so the RF energy doesn't get a chance to go through the radials and see Earth and heat up that Earth. So ways of shortening and ways of resonating is only doing half the job, in my opinion. You're falling a little bit short. When you take 60% length radials, you're falling a little bit short on the shielding the ground from the radiation. As you can see, I'm not a great enthusiast of quarter-wave ground plane antennas. You just take a very simple piece of wire, half-wavelength long electronically, whether you use loading coils, zigzags, top hat capacitors or whatever, mounted vertically above the ground as a vertical half-wave dipole. I know you're going to get a lot more bang for the money. That's what I strongly believe. And so techniques of resonating with stubs, it's a step in the right direction. I'm just not convinced all the effort is worth it and that it goes far enough, because it's only solving the resonating problem, not the shielding problem. It's falling short on the shielding problem to make sure that the RF energy is not seeing the Earth and acting as a dummy load and heating it up. K2KUI, K2LIW.
Yeah, Roger, this is K2KUI. Yeah, I'm not really a lover of quarter wave length vertical stuff on a revival. These ones that claim, you know, because of the elevated feed, no counterpoise, or the counterpoise becomes part of it as a simple little hanging on unit that they sell with it. I would say, Dick, that I have a sneaking suspicion that if you went ahead, now I'm going to say something, oh boy, am I going to get you know what for this. I will bet that you take that vertical dipole I have and was to compare it to one of these hundreds and hundreds of dollar verticals that they claim possibly with elevated speed. I will say that that vertical dipole, because I think it's basically what we're looking at, a form of that. I will say that most likely the vertical dipole is going to equal, and maybe, well, let's put it this way, equal the performance of that vertical with the elevated feed monopole over.
Yeah, I'm going to agree with you. Pure vertical dipole is going to be one of the very high performers. If you've got to put down radials because it's only a quarter wave resonator, and if you can either put down a lot of radials or raise the radials above the earth, as you raise the radials further and further above the earth, raise the whole antenna. Pretty soon you can slant them downward. At first a not quite 90 degree angle or 120 degree angle from the radiator, and eventually you can slant them all the way down 180 degrees away from the radiator, and you and I called it a half-wave vertical dipole. As you raise the whole thing above the ground, you can move in that direction. Another thing which people often confuse is that, hey, I don't have enough property. I can only lay down the radials to the north. I can't lay down enough of them to the south. I don't have enough property in that direction. Will that give me a weird pattern? And the answer in general is no. It's going to give you a little bit lower performance. If it goes to the south, you're heating up the soil a little bit more. But in order to change the pattern of an antenna, in general, it takes real estate to do that. And I mean wavelength of real estate. If I want to really control the pattern, I have to lay down radiators and counterpoises that are more than a half wavelength long to do anything substantial. A collinear antenna, which is multiple half wavelengths vertically stacked, a station master-like antenna. That has a pancake pattern. It's got the real estate, got multiple half wavelengths of real estate to control the pattern. Just skimping on some of the radials is going to have a very minor effect. The main effect that controls the pattern and the vertical radiation angle, in the case of a horizontal dipole, is how far away is the mirror image. A horizontal dipole above the ground is a mirror image of one below the ground. 180 degrees out of phase, the reflection off the ground gives you 180 degree phase reversal. So those two antennas separated by some number of half wavelengths is controlling your vertical elevation angle. It takes real estate to control pattern. You can't take something like a quarter wave monopole and twist it a little bit and say, gee, I'm gonna radiate a 30 degree beamlet instead of my normal 87 degree beamlet. You haven't invested in the real estate. You can jump up and down. You can use all kinds of magic and superconducting in there. It ain't going to happen. It takes interferometry. It takes, there's got to be two different portions of the antenna radiating in phase and out of phase, separated by more than a half wavelength to control pattern. Other than that, you're going to get a quasi-omnidirectional pattern no matter what you do. There are people who make very minor changes in the ground plane radials, and they say, gee, I'm steering the signal to the north. It's nice if you believe that. If you haven't made the investment, Mother Nature ain't gonna let you do that. It ain't that simple. Another opinion. KQKY, KQYW.
Roger, this is KQKY. In fact, I think that layout one I saw in the antenna handbook, where they have a center, support, and they just sloped a bunch of guide poles very close to the vertical. Just in other words, made a bunch of vertical guide poles. Just add them as you need them. Space, they add one to 10, 15, 20 meters, 40 meters. You know, all circles around this one support, a pole. I think that is a great way to go, a reasonable way to go, and yeah, you can have a lot of fun experimenting with different antennas and all, and have a pulley, pull them up. Have several pulleys up there, pull them up individually. You could, if you want to feed them individually, you can feed them that way. If you want, you can put a box in the center, a relay box, and switch one to the other. I think that is an elegant way to go, and I bet you it's reasonable price compared to what you've got to spend for some of these antennas that they, you know, they give you a lot of claims and all. I will almost bet that I know I'm going to get flack from this, but I know it looks pretty. You know, these antennas are very impressive, tight, with all these doodads and everything. And but I think Dick will also agree that I don't think you're going to do more than, and well, let's put it this way, that it won't outdo the vertical guide pole over.
You got it. And you and I have heard enough people reporting to us now who have done the side-by-side shootout, the experiment, where they have the $350 with all the fancy doodads and coils and whatever, quarter-wave ground plane radio on the ground, and with a slingshot or a bow and arrow, shoot a simple dipole in the air, 40 feet, and compare the results, and they're shocked. How can that $3 worth of dipole outperform the $300 antenna on the ground with all those fancy doodads? The two unfairnesses of that comparison. One is a very low above the ground antenna, the other one's considerably higher. One's horizontally polarized, one's vertically polarized. But you can even make the example a little bit more fair by comparing the fancy antenna on the ground to a pure vertical wider dipole. Even with the bottom of it only being a couple of feet off the ground, I think you're going to say, wow, why did I spend all that money when this thing works so well? That's part of what ham radio is. Real experimentation, not just fancy theory. Try it. If you don't like it, modify it, try it again. Talk to your buddies, find out what worked. Get some testimonials. Run some experiments with them where they give you signal strength reports. Your buddy in Pennsylvania has got a horizontal antenna. Your buddy in London has got a vertical antenna, and so on. Run some experiments. And don't just use one antenna. Use a whole array of them in the backyard with a couple of different coaxes coming in with a rotary switch in the shack. And you can transmit on one and receive on the other, or you can have a grand old time. Antenna experimenting can be fun. It doesn't have to be experimenting. It's an eye-opener. Not exactly common sense. If you study it theoretically, you open up a program called High Frequency Structure Simulator and try it, or Yagi Optimization, or any of these other modeling programs. You can study it that way if you want. But it's a good program. It'll give you pretty good results. Most of the time, you'll get the results faster by laying out the piece of wire, soldering it in, connecting it in the shack, turning it on, and saying, what do I hear? And how do I hear? How do they hear me? You can do five of those experiments in a day. There are people who are very skilled with a computer who say, I can model 10 antennas in a day. Which is the best way? Yeah. That's up to you. Not sure. We're getting very close to the bewitching hour, Mel. So maybe it's time we start signing off. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Yeah, this is K2KEY. 11 o'clock. I think Andy, they reset the machine. I think it's still got an hour to go. Am I correct? Over.
You're looking at a guy who forgot to reset his watch. Oh, well.
Andy, having a senior moment. I have it more often now than ever.
All right, let me...
I got one down the line here for you, Dick. Let's get back up to your neighborhood. Just how small can I go for a 432 EFE array? It's all yours, over.
Okay. There are guys who have done moon bounce with one single Yagi on 2 meters when they're talking to a substantial station. There are guys in 432 who have done it with two substantial Yagis. For the most part, you're not going to hear your own echoes with two Yagis. However, you take a look at the modern computer program, K2JT, Joe Taylor, Nobel Prize winner. And he wasn't a Nobel Prize winner because of his weak signal programs, but weak signal JT, WSJT, weak signal JT is what it stands for. You look at those series of programs, which will transmit a series of four tones, and it will receive very weak tones in the noise. That can give you more than 20 decibels of advantage. To be a really substantial moon bounce operator, back in my day, late 70s, early 80s, to reliably hear your own echoes off the moon on 432 required 16 Yagis. Then people started doing it with 8 Yagis. Nowadays, with a WSJT program, you might hear echoes, when I say hear, I put the word hear in parentheses, or in quotes. In other words, the program will hear the echo with a couple of Yagis. It used to be good moon bounce required 400 square feet of radio area. That number is coming down real fast these days with the fancy modulation and demodulation technique. So if you want 432 moon bounce, and as long as you're willing to talk to the big guns, I'm reasonably sure two good Yagis will do it. And you could rather easily build them with rather inexpensive materials. Or you can buy them. It'd be nice to have a kilowatt of power, but to my knowledge, the weakest station that has done moon bounce is, I think, 150 watts and one single Yagi on 2 meters. I think it's been worse. When you do WSJT and you're talking to a pretty big gun, a guy who's pretty well equipped on the other end. Now, as you put more and more effort into the system, radiate more and more close to a 1500 watts key down, use more and more antennas, the echoes get louder, the signals get louder, the number of people you can talk to increases, and I gotta be a little bit careful on the word talk to. A moon bounce QSO in the past used to be very weak signal, Morse code, and you recognize the call letters, you recognize the signal strength report, and you send each other cards, and you call it a contact. Technically, it is a contact. But I have seen a number of people who get into moon bounce with excessive expectations. They expect to be talking to everybody in the world who can see the moon simultaneously. Well, the word talk to, you got to put in quotes. There are a couple of pretty strong stations that are able to, with a 28-foot dish, send reasonably clean-sounding single sideband to each other. But those are rare people. Not many are doing that. And you have to choose the right time of the month when the moon's vibration, which gives you Doppler spreading, is not too bad. It doesn't give too much wobble to the signal. For the most part, moon bounce is not a rag-chewer's mode. Mel and I and the guys who are listening are doing the equivalent of rag-chewing right now. We're sending words back and forth, 120 words a minute. We're comparing concepts. We're teaching each other things. For the most part, you don't do that on moon bounce. If you did moon bounce exclusively for the next 2 years, and you never had a chance to really pick somebody's brain and really talk to them, you're going to get a little bit lonely. Ham radio is a process by which it's a continuous learning curve. That's part of the fun of it. You're comparing ideas with other smart guys, and you're learning things. Moon bounce doesn't supply that in that form. Now, that's an opinion. There are heavy moon bounce operators that will strongly disagree with that. They'll say this guy, K2RIW, he's done very little moon bounce in his life, and he's knocking it.